Let's just forge ahead and meet a new character, Callicles, who is rather interesting, a rather remarkable person. He is, as far as we know, a fictional character, because there's no other attestation for his existence outside of Plato's Gorgias. Now, that doesn't mean he's fictional, but some people suspect that he could be, because there's no independent verification of his existence. I guess nothing really depends on that, but he is a very well-drawn and vivid character. And there's certain characteristics about Callicles that are actually truly admirable. Although he's thoroughly shameless and unscrupulous, or almost thoroughly shameless and unscrupulous, but he has a number of intellectual virtues. One is this, that he's tough-minded. He's really thought out his positions and realizes that in order to defend what he wants to defend, which is injustice, basically, one has to overturn all conventional notions of right and wrong. If one's going to advocate the life that the sophists advocate, which is a life of pursuing power in the city, and one's going to do that well and have all the advantages one can gather over one's opponents, one's going to have to give up on all conventional notions of right and wrong. This is something that Gorgias doesn't want to do. He's clearly a man who wants to maintain some sort of moral standards. And Polus eventually succumbs to this too. Because Polus, although he will not say that doing injustice is bad, still argues that doing injustice is shameful. And this is how Socrates defeats him. And before we go into the Callicles section, I want to look at that argument with Polus, because we didn't have a chance to go over it last time. Other characteristics of Callicles that seem to be admirable, in my view, is he's not conventional in his thinking. And that's really a prerequisite for being truly philosophical. No matter how much lip service one might feel it prudent to pay to moral or public conventions, one's thinking can't be impeded by notions that are merely accepted because they're conventional. And Callicles has liberated his mind to a greater degree than Gorgias and Polus from notions of justice that he thinks are purely conventional. And Socrates talks about how he's outspoken, and his frankness, his outspokenness, really refers to his refusal to be cowed by concerns about what other people think of him, and merely conventional concerns about his reputation. A third thing that I think is really admirable about Callicles is that, and then this really is the flip side of his emancipation from the conventional, is his concern with what's right by nature. Callicles isn't a completely amoral person. He has a notion of what's right by nature, which is very much unlike a lot of the other sophists who really didn't have a notion of right at all. Callicles has a notion of right by nature, and he cleaves to this in a rigorous way, and it's on the basis of this that he argues for the admirability of this life that the sophists teach, the public life, the life pursuing freedom through power. Now, what Socrates does with Callicles is he basically accepts Callicles' outspokenness, his unconventionality, his appeal to nature. He doesn't quibble with that at all, because that's, as far as Socrates is concerned, admirable. And true, what Socrates does is he argues that Callicles' understanding of what's right by nature leads to a very different life than the life that he recommends. And in fact, the life led by a person who's guided by natural considerations about what's right and wrong, as opposed to purely conventional ones, turns out to be the philosophical life. So Callicles is very, very close to philosophy. And part of the reason why he is such an ungentlemanly character is his closeness to philosophy. Because to philosophize, one has to emancipate oneself from conventional notions of the fine and the good. And that tends to make a person somewhat rough and ungentlemanly. And that's certainly the case with Callicles. Polus and Gorgias are far more gentlemanly characters, so Gorgias especially the case. And Gorgias, of the three, is the most conventional, too. He's bound by what people think is good behavior and honorable behavior. And many of these things that people think are honorable are purely matters of convention that have nothing to do with natural or real human excellence. So let's first look at this argument that Socrates gives at the end of the Polus section, and then we'll take up what Callicles says about it. So let's turn ourselves to page 61, actually the bottom of 60. I just want to sort of run through this quickly and summarize what's being said. Polus claims that rhetoricians have power in cities. Now, Socrates denies that they have power. Polus says the token of their power is the same as the kinds of powers that are exercised by tyrants. It's their ability to kill their enemies, confiscate their possessions, exile their enemies. And Socrates argues that rhetors and tyrants have the least power, because what power really is doing what one really wants to do. And since freedom and power are interchangeable here, and have been since Gorgias introduced the idea of freedom and power being the highest good for man, you could also put it this way, that freedom is doing what you really want to do. And who would deny that, right? Freedom is doing what you really want to do. Well, what do we really want to do? We want to do the good. And that implies, though, that when we have a want or a wish to not do something good, that we're not really free. Now, why would a person who means well, and Socrates does believe that all normally constituted human beings pursue the good, why would a person who wants to pursue the good decide not to pursue it? Well, there are basically two kinds of answers. One is ignorance, right? And the other would be some kind of internal disorder of the soul. For instance, the passions are too strong and overcome one's better judgment. But when that happens, when one is ignorant of one's good, or one's knowledge of the good is overwhelmed by one's passions, and one acts to pursue something other than the good, Socrates says, you're not powerful, you're weak, you're not free, you're enslaved by ignorance of the passions, because you're doing something other than you really want, which is to pursue the good. Tyrants and rhetors have the power to get their way, most of the time, but the fact of the matter is that the things that they choose with their power are not good for them, and therefore their power is merely illusory. It's real enough, they can make people miserable. They're not powerful or free enough to pursue what they really want, which is the good. And so there's a kind of hollowness to their position in the world. Now, one implication of this view is this, that one can be forced to be free. This is Rousseau's formulation, and you find this on the Social Contract, published 1762. Napoleon carried a copy of the Social Contract with him at all times. And when he invaded Russia, the Grand Army was moving towards Russia, somebody asked Napoleon, why in the world were they going to Russia? And he took out his copy on the Social Contract and held it up, and he said, because man must be forced to be free. And that's what he was going to do. He was going to go to Russia and force those people to be free. And the sad thing is that he failed. But that was his aim, and that would have been the outcome. Russia was a society with an absolute monarchy. There was no such thing as the rule of law. And the vast majority of Russians were serfs at the time, and remained serfs for decades afterwards, until serfdom was finally abolished. The Russians didn't want it that way, but that was because they were deluded. And he was going to force them to do what they really want, which is to live a decent life under the rule of law. He was going to force them to be free. This claim that one can be forced to be free is regarded by many people as just totalitarianism and newspeak, right? The French Revolution created a republic. Right, which was the rule of law, the idea that all human beings are free and equal in some way, and that they should be citizens ruled by laws. The Republic, unfortunately, was not capable of governing itself, and so Napoleon ended up being the dictator of the Republic, and then the emperor after he crowned himself that. But at every step of the process, he was guided by the idea that, look, a legitimate government makes the citizens free. And he also believed, what Rousseau believed, that the ideal government governs with the consent of the governed. However, it's not the consent of the governed that you would find by just polling them every day and finding out if they consent to this. It's what they would consent to if they were rational and consulted their interests. But the trouble is that people aren't rational. And so most of the choices that most people make at most times are really not in their best interests. And so Napoleon decided, look, we just can't have this notion of democratic self-government because these people are giving up their freedom. So he had to assume power and force these people to be free. Okay? And he then proceeded to force everybody in Europe that he could get his hands on to be free in the same way. The fact of the matter is that he did have an enormously positive effect throughout Europe. This is one of the reasons why Hegel saw Napoleon as a world historical figure, because once Napoleon swept through and overturned the very much antiquated absolute monarchies most of Europe, and set up constitutional forms of government, even after his defeat, there was no turning back. And so virtually every society after him in Europe made great efforts to have constitutional forms of government, one set of laws that governed everybody. It was an extraordinary historical shift. One thing that we need to do is just examine this notion, can you be forced to be free? What does that entail? Well, it entails this. If it's the case that your passions and your ignorance are leading you to make choices that are not conducive to your well-being, it might be the case that somebody can forcibly intervene and prevent you from doing that. In which case, you're not being made less free, but you're being made more free if the intervention leads you to make choices that really are in your interest, which is what you really want to do anyway. So, for instance, paternalistic legislation against, you know, addictive drugs and things like that. Many people regard this as just an intolerable imposition on our freedom. The government's forcing us not to take certain things. But the view is that, look, these are the kinds of things that anybody who was rational and informed about the meaning of their choices and what they really wanted, these are the sorts of things that no one would choose to take anyway. And if people are so foolish and ignorant as to take them, well, it's society's duty to prevent them from making that terrible mistake, thereby making them freer individuals than they would have been otherwise. Now, this gives a great deal of space for state paternalism. And Plato's a big paternalist. But this is the flip side of the idea that tyrants aren't free or powerful. They aren't free or powerful because they aren't doing what they really want to do. And that means that if you were to forcibly remove a tyrant, you could make them more free and actually empower them in a certain way by preventing them from making wicked choices. This was a point I wanted to make before. This paternalistic teaching follows directly from this. And the notion of liberty that's discussed here is often called positive versus negative liberty. Positive liberty is the ability to get what you really want. It has a sense of empowerment, informedness, I guess, proper direction in one's choices. When one makes choices that are directed toward what's right, what's genuinely good for you, and one knows what's good for you, and one has the power to actually choose these things, this is the exercise of liberty in the positive sense. It's substantive, and the goal is the good. Versus negative liberty, which is simply the idea that one is left free to do whatever one sees fit. Negative liberty is perfectly protected in any case where a person decides, well, I'm going to go home and drink myself into a stupor because it's my home and it's my booze and I'm not infringing on anybody else's rights. Okay, the great advocates of the permissive society, the legalize everything society, are always presupposing a notion of negative liberty. That if your choices don't affect the equal liberty of others to make similar sorts of choices, then there's nothing objectionable about them. Whether or not that choice be, you know, shooting yourself in a moment of despair, or getting yourself addicted to drugs, or whatever, as long as it's not hurting anybody else, the assumption is nobody has any right to complain. And so Socrates is a great positive libertarian. And the other great positive liberty people in the history of thought would be somebody like Rousseau. Hegel is another positive liberty person. There's a direct line from Plato's Gorgias to Rousseau's social contract, Hegel's philosophy of right. Although the philosophy of punishment is the same. Hegel actually argues, look, criminals have a right to demand punishment. If we don't punish them, we're violating their rights. Why? Because what is the right that they can appeal to if we don't punish them? The right is the right to pursue their own good. And the only way to pursue the good, if your soul is sick or disordered, is to have it corrected, cured. And that's what punishment is for. Now, Louisa, you were saying, what about the sociopath? Well, Socrates does include the possibility that some people's souls are incurably sick. And his assumption is these people are better off dead.
Well, are they allowed to shoot themselves?
No, they're not allowed to shoot themselves. No. They have to be duly executed. That's lawlessness. That's vigilanteism. We can't have that. So I'm being semi-facetious, but there's something serious about this. It's perfectly consistent for a society to make suicide illegal and capital punishment legal, right? Because suicide is not a lawfully governed activity that's somehow regulated in a way that we hope will respect the rights of individuals. It's just murder of another sort. It's a kind of lawless activity, whereas capital punishment, we hope, is law-governed and just. Now, again, the conception of punishment here, we have to be very careful about. The conception of punishment is a rehabilitative notion of punishment. But he does have the idea that there are certain people...
How can you get rehabilitated when you're executed?
Well, but the idea is this. The idea is this. There are some people who are incurably evil. And the fact that they're evil means that they're suffering. And the fact that they're incurable means that the longer they live, the more they suffer. So, in effect, capital punishment is euthanasia. That's how he looks at it. It's very clear that, in a way, his own death was sort of a suicide.
So,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It was a lawful suicide. You have to admit that. I'm being somewhat facetious, but the state was the one that forced him to do it, so it was sort of regulated by law, but it was clearly the case that he could have avoided the trial, and he could have avoided the death sentence if he had so chosen. But the fact is that the Greeks didn't have the view that most modern Westerners do, that life is unconditionally valuable. And so suicide was not a rare phenomenon. We have a tendency to think that life is unconditionally valuable, and therefore suicide should be illegal. My attitude is this, that suicide should be illegal. It should be illegal for this reason, that most people who try and kill themselves don't really want to kill themselves. And if it's illegal, then it empowers other people and the authorities to try and intervene, which is what the person really wants anyway. So again, we're forcing people to be free by empowering society to intervene to prevent them from killing themselves. You know, if it weren't a crime, people could sue the police or Good Samaritans, things like that, for helping them do something that they really want to do, to live and maybe get the kind of help they need to make their life more bearable. I mean, that's the assumption. You know, clearly the way our society works is very different from the principles, if you will, of legal right that Socrates holds to. We have more of a negative liberty society than a positive liberty society. And so the argument, let this guy go, is always more compelling than the argument, keep him and try and improve him, We just don't, we're not set up for rehabilitative kinds of activities for the most part. Let's go on to this next argument. And this is the argument that Socrates really sort of wraps up Polus with, and then we'll go on to Callicles. Polus claims that doing injustice is shameful, but it's not bad. The fine isn't the same as the good, and the shameful isn't the same as the bad, according to Polus. Fine things are fine because they all participate in some idea of the fine, Socrates says. Isn't that right? If you say that two things are fine, isn't that because they share some common characteristic, fineness? Well, what is this characteristic of fineness, he says? And Socrates suggests two characteristics of fine things. One is that they confer some kind of use or benefit. They're good. And the other is that they confer some kind of pleasure. So fineness consists in benefit and pleasure, goodness and pleasure. And the shameful, conversely, would be something that's useless and bad, or displeasing, right? Or both. Okay. And Polus claims that suffering injustice is bad and doing injustice is shameful. Okay, so Polus says suffering injustice is bad and doing injustice is shameful, but doing injustice isn't bad, is his claim. And Socrates basically asks this, if doing injustice is more shameful than suffering it, it must be more shameful because it's either more bad or more painful, right? Doing injustice is either, if doing injustice is worse than suffering injustice because it's more shameful, then it has to be either more bad or more painful. But he says suffering injustice is far more painful than doing it. So if doing injustice is a shameful thing, it's not shameful because it hurts you. It doesn't hurt you, it hurts somebody else. Well, that implies by process of elimination that doing injustice is shameful because it's bad. So this distinction that Polus wants to maintain between what's shameful and bad collapses. Because, again, shameful things are either shameful because they're bad or because they're painful. Doing injustice isn't painful, therefore if it's shameful, it has to be shameful because it's bad. And Polus is sort of flummoxed by this. He can't answer this argument. So Socrates, again, he concludes that doing injustice must exceed suffering injustice, not in terms of being painful, but in terms of badness. Doing injustice is therefore not just shameful, it is bad, and it is harmful because it is bad. Okay? Bad and harmful are basically the same thing here. And therefore, he argues that paying a penalty, being punished, in other words, is better than not paying a penalty. Why? Because paying a just penalty means being punished justly. And then he announces this general principle that whenever something is done to somebody in a particular way, the person who receives this treatment is affected in the way that the treatment is given. So, for instance, if you administer a just punishment to a person, that person is affected by being made more just. So what a just punishment is something that makes the person more just who gets punished. Well, we hope forever, but they might have to come back. You know, they have to take the whole prescription too. You can't stop your antibiotic. When you feel better and you can't get out of jail, just when you say that you feel better. But the point is that, of course, he doesn't use that analogy, but I like it. So what happens is, if you're punished justly, you become more just. To become more just is to be benefited. Okay? Therefore, people who are punished justly are benefited from this. And in fact, they have a right to be benefited from this. Why? Because the right is, in a sense, the right to their own happiness or their own self-actualization. We have the right to pursue happiness, according to Socrates. And that means that we have the right to demand the appropriate punishments when our souls are disordered. Okay. And that a person who escapes, who does something bad and escapes punishment, is worse off than a person who does something bad and gets caught and gets punished, if they're properly punished. Now, again, when you deal with our sort of society, you have to think, well, you know, you might not be able to say that's true. A person who does something bad and gets away with it is probably better off, given our penal system, than somebody who does something bad, gets caught, and gets thrown into jail for 20 years. Because we don't have much pretense anymore about benefiting people by, you know, sticking them in a maximum security prison. But the ideal notion of a penitentiary, right, is where one becomes penitent and morally regenerated. And that notion comes from Plato, really. His theory of punishment is quite revolutionary. As far as we know, before that, conceptions of punishment were purely retributive. This is a code of Hammurabi, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And that was about it. Plato's notion of punishment that's supposed to be morally regenerative seems entirely new in the history of penology. And there's actually a couple of books that have been written on Plato's penal codes and things like that, because in the Laws, for instance, he talks about this. And the basis of a theory of punishment is found in this text. So anyway, Polus is defeated in his claim that doing injustice is shameful but not bad. And what Callicles says is, well, you know, Polus has just been defeated because he holds to conventional notions of the shameful. If he were willing to say that doing injustice is bad and it's not shameful because nothing really is shameful, then he would have wriggled away from Socrates' argument. And it's kind of interesting here because we get a distinction between, if you will, the fine versus the good. The fine is this rubbery Greek term, kalon, which can be fine or noble or beautiful, and the good is, in Greek, it's agathon. And the assumption here when we talk about what's good or what's right by nature is that there's a kind of objectivity and naturalness about this, whereas what's fine is what we think is fine around here. It's a conventional notion of what's fine. And so to be a fine person is to do the kinds of things that fine people do around here. You know, a refined person doesn't belch loudly at the table or pass gas. Whereas in other societies, that might be considered a compliment to the cooking or something like that. We have very different standards of what counts as refinement, and they're different from place to place and time to time. The Tibetans greet you as a respected guest by sticking out their tongues and hissing at you, whereas in the Bronx, that means an entirely different thing. But the point is that what makes you a fine gentleman in Tibet makes you an uncouth lout in the United States. And so there's a kind of conventionality about the fine versus a naturalness and universality about the good. It is relative from time to time and place to place, because it has to do with conventions by which we signal certain things to people, and those conventions can be different and sometimes mean exactly the opposite things at different times and different places. And when you think about manners, for instance, this is the most purely conventional dimension of what gentlemanly behavior is, or refined behavior is. Right? And the Greek word for gentleman is kalos kai agathos. It means fine and good. And what Socrates is trying to do is he's trying to play up the dimension of the good here, because there's a sense that the good is more objective than the fine. The fine and good man is the gentleman. The question is, are our senses of what is fine in line with what is good? That would be the best sort of circumstance, right, where you adjust your conventions to accord with what's really good. Now, to some extent, you know, you can just have any old conventions, as long as people understand them, because what they do is they perform a function of say, showing respect to a person's dignity or worth, right? Whether you do it by shaking hands or sticking out your tongue or other things like that is really immaterial, as long as everyone recognizes what it means. But the idea is that conventions should in some way be harmonized with what's right by nature. Now, poor Polus wants to maintain that injustice is good. Doing injustice is good, but it's not fine. And the opposite of the fine is the shameful. And what Socrates is doing is he's arguing that what's shameful has to be because it's bad, as well as unpleasurable, right? Or both. And by bringing in the bad as definitive of the shameful is equivalent to making the good definitive of the fine. And so what he does is he undermines poor Polus's argument. Because Polus is going to hold on to the idea that doing justice is a fine thing, and doing injustice is a shameful thing, which is a kind of conventional notion. And he's going to deny that doing injustice is bad. He's going to say it's a good thing to do. And what's he appealing to? He's appealing to some standard of nature. And we're going to find out what that standard is when we look at Callicles, because what Callicles basically does is it says, look, Polus, you've got yourself defeated because you were so caught up with this idea that we should, respect conventional notions of the fine. But if we don't do this, if we basically argue that nothing is fine or shameful, that it's really only what's good and bad by nature, then you can maintain that doing injustice is good. And it doesn't matter if it's shameful. It doesn't matter. Because shame and fine, the shameful, the noble, these are merely conventional things, and we should sweep these away and pay no mind to them. And Polus, unfortunately, didn't do that, and so Socrates got him. So Callicles says, I'm going to escape this problem, because for me, nothing is shameful, he says. That's purely matters of convention. The only thing that I want to do is what's good, and what's good is by nature, not convention. And what is what's good by nature for Callicles? Well, it's the survival of the fittest, the rule of the strongest. Might makes right. That's Callicles' standard. And so let's look at Callicles' marvelous speech. Let's turn to page 72-73. At the bottom of 72 and the top of 73, he says, Polus failed because he pays mind to conventional notions. About 5 lines down, he says, for Socrates, you really, on 73, for Socrates, you really lead the discussion into such tiresome things suited to a popular speaker while claiming to pursue the truth. He's saying, Socrates, your appeal is merely ad populum. It's to the conventional notions of right and wrong. You say you're pursuing the truth, but you're really just exploiting conventional mindedness in your opponents. And the fact of the matter is that that's true. Socrates really does exploit these sorts of things to get his opponents to come around to his way of thinking. He will take completely commonplace and highly dubious notions of good or right or shameful or noble, and he'll exploit them to try and move his opponents around to his position. And Callicles is admirable, again, in his tough-mindedness, in his ability to see through this, because his mind is so completely emancipated from any conventional notions. His thinking isn't limited by these things. Okay, and he goes on, and he says, he claimed to pursue the truth. Things that are not fine by nature, but by convention. And in most cases, these things are opposed to each other, nature and convention. If, therefore, someone feels ashamed and doesn't dare say what he thinks, he is compelled to say contradictory things. And now, having thoroughly understood this piece of wisdom, you work evil in the arguments. If someone speaks the things according to convention, you slip in questions about things according to nature. And if he speaks of the things of nature, you ask about the things of convention. And Socrates is constantly weaving back and forth and using this to destroy his opponent's arguments. And he's very, very clever in doing this. And Callicles sees right through it. At the center of page 73, he says, "For by nature, everything is more shameful that is also worse. So he's saying the fine and the good are the same. And as it turns out, what's good is precisely the stuff that people say isn't fine, that's shameful. So there, Callicles is arguing for a complete identity of the fine and the good. But the standard is going to be what's good according to nature, and we have to reform our notions of what's fine or noble in accordance with what's good according to nature. Now, what poor Polus did is he maintains that doing injustice is a good thing, but he maintains the conventional notion that it's shameful. Whereas what he really needs to do is he should say, look, the only things that are shameful are the things that are bad by nature, and what's bad by nature is suffering injustice, and what's good by nature is doing it. So there's no shame in doing injustice. And in a way, you could just dispense with this whole language of the fine, right? Because if it's just exactly the same as what the good is, you can just sweep away all of your conventional moral notions about fine and shameful behavior and just go with what's good or bad by nature. And this is how Callicles wants to proceed. And he goes on, okay, so again, by nature, everything is more shameful that is also worse, such as suffering injustice, whereas by convention, doing injustice is more shameful. Nor does this misfortune, suffering injustice, belong to a man, but to some slave for whom it is superior to die than to live, who, suffering injustice and being trampled in the mud, is unable to help himself or anyone else he cares for. But I think those who set down the laws are the weak human beings and the many. It is therefore in reference to themselves and their own advantage that they set down laws and praise their praises and blame their blames, frightening away the more powerful human beings and those with power to have more, so that they won't have more than themselves. They say that taking more is shameful and unjust, and that doing injustice is this, seeking to have more than the others. For they are quite contented, I think, if they themselves have an equal share, since they are lowlier. This is Nietzsche, you know. Plato's gotten all of Nietzsche right, long before Nietzsche came along. But Nietzsche's saying that any notion of egalitarianism is just the revenge of the nerds, of the weak. this is just this is the voice of the downtrodden, the people who benefit from this. People who are strong aren't for equality, it's only people who are weak, because it's the weak who have all the, you know, everything to gain. So the noble individual doesn't talk about equality or pity or charity. This is the mealy-mouthed ethics of weak people who benefit from it, and that's all that it amounts to, just the advantage of the weaker. But this is the first attested discussion or known discussion of the idea of what's right by nature. The idea is this. There is some sense that we have a capacity for discerning this that's distinct from our capacity to know by know conventions. How you boil this down, well, that's another thing. Some people argue that you can learn what's right by nature in the realm of morals, which deals with the care of the soul, right? In the same way that physicians know what's right by nature in the care of the body. Well, here we're talking about the right, and the right and wrong has to do with the care of the soul, the moral dimension, right? There's a morality by nature which is strictly analogous to health in the body. Virtue is the health of the soul. Vice is the sickness. Now, and the question then becomes this. Well, how do doctors know what's right by nature? That clearly we do have some standards of health and disease. There's some desire to formulate this in terms of rules and things like that. 98.6 is a normal temperature. These things are good rules of thumb to get us started, but the fact is that there are variances in healthy temperatures between people. We don't all know what's healthy for us just by our own experience. Oftentimes we have to go to doctors and professionals. But the more you read about it, the more you become habituated, introspecting, and thinking about your own states, the better capable you are of saying, you know, I'm feeling sick. How do you know that you're sick? Well, you feel bad. Right? And how do you know that your soul is sick? Well, you feel bad. You have these pathological states, antipathies, anxieties, and things like that. How do you know that your soul's in health? Well, your soul sort of feels good. What happens is when you feel bad or feel good, spiritually speaking, what you need to do is you need to go to a soul doctor. The soul doctor says, they'll tell me about it.
and you start describing your symptoms, and it says, you know, it sounds to me like you've got a problem with procrastination, or a problem with death, or a problem with this or that. And they try and say, well, you know, maybe you should do these things, or try this on for size, and see if you feel better. And it just works like that. And the idea is that there can be long traditions of experience that are built up over time that embody a great deal of knowledge or wisdom about the body, for instance. So gnosis isn't just a matter of applying, you know, quick ready-made rules to people's physical conditions. It's really a kind of diagnostic art. And the older a physician is, and the more they've seen, the more refined they are in figuring out what's wrong. And it's the kind of thing you can't really articulate necessarily or adequately in a set of propositions, but it's a kind of refined sensibility that allows you to tell when a person's healthy or sick, right? And then once you sort of have a sense of what's wrong, you can sort of nudge them back to the healthy state, whatever it is for that particular person. Well, the idea is the same if you follow the analogy in ethics. There are some people who are moral connoisseurs, if you will, or have the art of moral diagnostic. And on the basis of experience, they can sort of see what's troubling people, elicit information from them necessary to sort of narrow down their diagnoses, and say, well, maybe you should try this and see if you feel better. It's a very much a kind of empirically based, but experientially refined kind of activity. And Aristotle is very good at describing the kind of knowledge that goes into this. And the other person I really think who's just a master at getting to the essence of what moral knowledge is Adam Smith and his theory of moral sentiments. Fortunately, you don't have to go it alone. There's a vast tradition of knowledge that's been gathered and refined over time that we can tap into through liberal education, through listening to people who are older and wiser than ourselves and have actually allowed the experience to gel into something, as opposed to the people who've just gone through life and just never really learned anything from a... there are people like that. They're called old fools, right? That's how we know what's right by nature. It's a process of studying human beings, seeing what makes their souls flourish and what makes their souls miserable, developing the kind of refined perception of what constitutes sickness and health in very concrete situations with different characters and temperaments, and learning to become introspective about our own states and things like that. Convention is very different. There are people who are conventionally well off, right? People who are rich. But by nature, they're not well off. Why? Because they're not happy. Okay. You see, that's a kind of distinction like that. In the law, there's the law in the books, and then there's this notion of equity, right? There are some people who think, well, how do you assure justice? Well, you go in there and you mechanically apply the law in every case. You know, you have a deduction. You know, X is against the law. The defendant did X, therefore the defendant is guilty. Now, if people applied the law like that, we would have lots more fodder for these evening shows, the 2020s and things like that, which are always trying to dig up some outrageous case of some outrageous miscarriage of justice, and they tell it very effectively. And the reason why that kind of simple deductive model doesn't work is that there are all kinds of weird contingencies in life, and sometimes things that fit the description of a bad act or an unjust act, if you understand it in its context, is completely excusable. And what happens is we give judges a certain leeway to make decisions. And what's the assumption? Well, the assumption is that the law on the books is an attempt to get to what's just. However, there are certain circumstances that can never be anticipated by the legislators, which will sometimes make the application of the law in a mechanical and blind way unjust, and therefore the judge has the capacity to use his own moral vision to discern when the law needs to be set aside or transformed in the name of justice. And the assumption, therefore, is that we do have a faculty for tracking the just, the right by nature, over and above the rules that we've come up with over time. And that this notion of equity, which is a term that you find comes out of Aristotle's ethics, is an attempt to talk about how human beings try and make our rules and regulations get closer to what's right by nature. And the assumption is that certain people like judges who should be reflective people who have looked at the case law and have seen all this endless parade of people coming through the courtroom, after a while have a certain amount of experience and a certain amount of refinement and a moral sensibility that allows them to realize, hey, the mechanical and blind application of the law is an injustice in this case, a miscarriage of justice. Okay. And we do have this kind of intuitive knowledge of what's just. And people who have more experience with looking at cases and looking at human characters have a better and more refined intuitions.